Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We're thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. Your help keeps this podcast alive. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 375 of Registry Matters. What's up, Larry? How are you this evening?
Doing awesome. Glad we could be back on the air again.
Please head over to your favorite podcast app, or even your not so favorite podcast app, even like borrow your neighbor's podcast app and put a review in there. Press like, subscribe on the YouTube channel. Load up multiple browsers. You know, if you've got like Firefox and you've got Chrome and you've got Safari, load them all up and press the like button and subscribe on all of those different ones. That way you could ensure that we are rising to the top of the YouTube algorithm. What do you think about that plan?
I think it's a good plan, and I think we need to push people to get to that magic 1,000. We're so close, but yet
we are
not there yet. we get to 935, and all of a sudden, two or three of them unsubscribe. I guess I say something that irritates them, and it'll drop back down two or three, and then a couple more will come.
You say things that irritate people? That shocks me.
Well, I can't imagine what else would cause them to unsubscribe. Can you?
Not at all. So what are we doing tonight?
Well, we have a decision from the Colorado Supreme Court. And the issue in that case is whether or not the SVP's designation is unconstitutional. Does it impose punishment? And if it does it impose cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment? And also, we're going to talk about some bad legislation that's pending in the state of Michigan.
I see. Well, very well. Then we will do that one first. And so there's this bill banning PFRs from youth. I should say Ute. We still need to watch that movie, Larry. We're going to do it very soon. We're going to do it. PFRs from Ute-related jobs spurs public safety debate. And this is from Lansing, Michigan. And a House committee has advanced bills seeking to ban those listed on the state's PFR registry from working at businesses that primarily serve minors. Michigan parents who testified before the House Judiciary Committee said the legislation is necessary to safeguard their chirrens outside of school. Now, was our side there to respond?
Yes, they actually were this time. Criminal justice advocacy organizations that opposed the package said the bills could also negatively impact individuals registered for crimes not committed against children by implementing new barriers to them finding work. Now, we don't want people to work, do we? And
no.
Miriam Alkerman, who's an attorney from the ACLU of Michigan, said the bill is, quote, well-intentioned, but it's flatly unconstitutional. Ms. Alkerman was definitely telegraphing that they intend to bring a lawsuit against the legislation should it pass.
House Bill 5425, for those keeping score at home, sponsored by Representative Matthew, Bierlein? What do you think that is?
I think we've agreed last time we discussed this person. It's Bierlein, yes.
Okay, cool. And that's a Republican from Vassar County would amend Michigan's PFR registration law to prohibit registered individuals from being employed by a business that primarily provides services to individuals under the age of 18. That seems pretty vague to me.
I agree with you, and that's the feedback and chatter. The bill package lists examples like martial arts and dance studios, summer camps, tutoring companies, youth sports venues, bowling alleys, and escape rooms. And I remember we talked about escape rooms before because I didn't know what one was. but we didn't have those back in the 1800s.
No, certainly not. They were different back then. You tried to escape from them, but they were hard.
But people on the PFR register who violate the bill would be guilty of a misdemeanor punishable by up to 1 year imprisonment or a $1,000 fine. With a second violation, the punishment increases to a four-year term and a $2,000 fine. This bill would also require the state to provide notice of employment restrictions to those on the registry.
Now, Representative Bierlein said he introduced the bill package after parents in his district raised serious concerns about a gap in our current law. He said, while PFRs cannot work in schools, they are not prohibited from working in or even operating businesses that primarily provide services to minors.
Well, he's correct about that, but I don't know how long I don't remember the research we did on that representative last time, but I think he's fairly new and he may not know the history, but Michigan's SORA, the Sex Offender Registration Act, does not itself restrict employment for those registered through those, although those limits were imposed in the law at one time, and they were included prior to previous lawsuits. But other Michigan laws, like the state's school code, generally prohibit school districts and non-public schools from employing an individual if the criminal history check shows they've been convicted of a sex offense. Bierlein said that policy reflects a clear understanding that children deserve a safe and protected environment. Now, that's pretty good logic. Since we've already limited them from working in schools, we might as well just keep expanding the limit. Can you at least admit that that makes logical sense?
I suppose, like, I'm trying to think of the dance studio that the person goes in there and says, I would like to be employed here. And they do some kind of background check and they're like, you were convicted of doing naughty things in this regard. We would prefer you not be employed here. And that would just be the end of it. I don't see why we need to make it more illegal that the person be in this predicament.
But what if the PFR creates the business him or herself? Then we can't have that. Entrepreneurship, we can't have that.
I thought thought we were in favor of entrepreneurship in this country.
No, we're not.
I see. All right. Well, Logan Christian, a parent from Bierlein's district who testified in support of the bills, said on the eve of his son's first first martial arts tournament, he was notified by another parent that his child's mentor had been convicted of child sexual abuse. Like nearly every adult I have spoken to, my wife and I assumed from the very beginning that a child PFR type person could not possibly own and operate a child's martial arts studio, he said, and therefore it would be safe for our son to attend.
Oh boy. Now I tell you, when I tell you these bills are pushed, the lawmaker, Bierlein, didn't think this up himself. A constituent brought it to him. And he said, wow, fantastic, I'll do this. But anyway, there are other opinions presented to lawmakers. Jessica Zimbelman, who's a deputy director in the State Appellate Defender's Office, spoke on behalf of the criminal defense attorneys of Michigan, said the burden should be on the employers to ensure the people they hire are fit to work with children. And I think that's a good point because you got legal liability potential. She said the bill as written out is brushing with broad strokes. She also said, I too am a parent, telling the committee she would do anything to protect her children. This bill doesn't do that though. She said the PFR registry as it exists now is bloated and includes people who are registered despite not having committed offense against children. According to Zimbelman, the registry now has nearly 45,000 people in it. The bill would prohibit every single one of them, regardless of their risk of reoffending or what their offense actually was, from working in these listed places or even volunteering to give back to the community. Now, that's a pretty broad brush if it eliminates every PFR. And remember, we talk about narrowly tailored Michigan legislators. Bierlein, please listen to this. You can get away with this. It'll be constitutional if you will narrowly tailor it. Do it.
The article then states that three people on the PFR registry submitted written comments in opposition to the bill, with one saying limiting employment impairs my chances of success. Work is my survival. Work is how I support my family. Work is my dignity. I am more than my worst decision. Another said, we are attempting to reintegrate back into society and become productive citizens. By restricting our opportunities of employment, it not only hinders our adjustment to society again, but greatly reduces the opportunity to prove our own worth.
Well, those are good comments. Now, if they were being rational, those comments would mean something, but they don't mean much because we're not being rational. Again, the appellate defender Zimmelman said she believes the bill package is unconstitutional. She pointed to Michigan legislation passed in 2006 that prohibited PFRs from living, working, or loitering within 1,000 feet of a school. But the federal courts and the Michigan Supreme Court have struck those zones down as unconstitutional. The 1,000 feet zones were later removed from SOAR when the legislature amended it back in 2021. Beerlein apparently doesn't know or doesn't care about that.
Ms. Aukerman posted this question. How can you know whether a business primarily provides services to individuals under the age of 18? Is it a crime for a registrant to work as an after-hours cleaner for a hairdresser if a prosecutor can prove that half of the people getting haircuts are under 18? Can you see your point?
I can. This would be a terrible thing to try to figure out. And I tell you what, the people under supervision would be told, you just can't work anywhere if it's even a close call. That's what they would say. So I do get their point, and they will likely lose this in court if it passes. During a first committee hearing in February, Representative Gina Johnson, Republican from Portland, asked if there was an established definition for what primarily in the bill would mean. Sponsor Berlin said there isn't a lockdown definition, but said it was something he would look at to clarify. Well, apparently, hasn't been doing much clarification because that was when? February. February.
Yeah.
Now we're in May. Ms. Aukerman said litigating SORA has cost Michigan taxpayers millions of dollars, and these bills could be very expensive to defend and implement. But again, it doesn't come out, it comes out of the trough of taxpayer money. And It doesn't matter. All those arguments, mate, they're not as compelling as you would think they'd be, because so what if it costs us $5 million?
Right. Michigan's a pretty large state, too. It's not like, you know, a state with 500,000 people where, not that millions wouldn't mean much, but millions would mean way less to a state like Michigan.
It's a rounding error to a state of that size. I would bet their budget is well over $100 billion.
Holy crap. That's a lot of zeros.
So,
I kind of have a problem that why would one of the PFRs go, forget the guy owning the dance studio. That's a whole different thing. I can't figure out why the PFR would try to go get a job at a dance studio or something, you know, gymnastics thing where you've got preteens and young teenagers running around. That just seems like a massive recipe for disaster.
Well, I'm kind of confused by your question.
It just—it seems like I'm not saying that there necessarily should be a law, but it should be something that none of us would ever be like, that is where I'm going to go get a job. That is my calling. That is where I should be. I just spent 10 years in prison for doing something to someone in that category. This seems like a bad idea.
Well, maybe for the one who had done something in that category, but what about the person who didn't do anything in this category? Their offense was something
fair
else.
Point. Totally a fair point. It's just what I generally think of as a PFR.
Well, that's the problem with the population, the public in general. They think everybody's molested a child, and they have not.
That's very true.
That is very true. The budget, at a quick glance, AI says it's $88 billion. That's all.
You were pretty far off, Larry.
So, yeah, $88 billion.
You were 12 off. Well, you did. I guess you said hundreds of billions?
Well, and of course, I don't know if that's incorporating all the federal funds. Usually the federal sharing of revenue with states puts the budget well above what the state collects in tax revenue. All the states, whether they're conservative or liberal, they have their paws out grabbing every federal dollar that they can, while at the same time, they're talking about how big and bloated the federal government is. And I can't get a single conservative listener to be critical of that for some reason. I see you got me on a tangent about the budget because they say it's big and bloated, and yet they do everything they can to make it bigger and more bloated.
There is somebody here from Michigan who says, thank you so much for featuring this. Fortunately, we have a Michigan senator who could probably kill it and not bring up for a vote. But this is not certain yet.
Well, please don't reveal who that senator is if that person has not revealed themselves, because that's a career impediment and possibly a career breaker. So you don't want a person saying that unless they're comfortable with it being said. If they win by overwhelming majorities, if they win by 70-30 or have no opponent, But if that person is in a 5149 district, you could destroy their career. So don't reveal that person's name.
Yeah, certainly that. But I do want to bring that up because that is something that we talk about frequently, of if you can stop it before it gets anywhere, this thing being in committee, then you, no one has to go down in flames for actually being on the record for that vote.
Well, that is true. But if the committee, if it stalls in the committee, the chairperson gets the blame for that, because theoretically the chair can call a bill up for vote. So the chair takes the heat for a bill not being heard. The best way to do it is Michigan. It doesn't work that way because they have a year-round legislature. But the best way to do it in these part-time states is just to run the clock out, and you let everybody vote yes. And you just flat run out of time. And you say, we wish it had made it to the finish line. We got it through the committee process, and damn it, it was on the floor, and we just ran out of time.
And Michigan's one of those states that's year-round too, huh?
Yes, they're year-round. At least when I lived there, they were, and I doubt that has changed.
Interesting. Do you have any idea the calculus behind that thing? Because, like, Pennsylvania is one. I'm assuming California is too.
I don't
just
have
by their
any
size.
Idea. But Texas is not, and they're much bigger than than most other states, so I don't know the
I
size.
I can see why Texas isn't, because they don't want any laws, because Texas is special.
So I think it's probably just the complexity of government and them changing the law. We've had efforts underway to lengthen our sessions, but the public says no. You do enough damage in these short sessions. The public doesn't really see the need. Just like we're the only state that doesn't provide any salary for the legislators and the public says, well, that's fine. They're crooked enough as it is.
Right. Absolutely.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there, too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, well then, let's move along. We have this case from Timothy Paul Beagle versus the people of the state of Colorado. The state Supreme Court held that the sexually violent predator SVP designation under section 18-3-414.5 and then CRS, what is CRS, Colorado what?
Revised
statute, maybe?
Statutes, yes.
Yes, I've learned something after 8 years. Colorado revised statute and its accompanying requirements do not constitute punishment under the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Do not constitute punishment. That does not sound as though this is a win.
It's not a win. It's a complete wipeout.
You can't help yourself, can you? You want to just like open every program and just give us the biggest doom and gloom possible, don't you?
Well, what do you mean? Help myself from what? I'm just here to report all the facts. That's all.
Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. Can you say it all dry like that? Like, what was his name?
That's Joe Friday.
Joe Friday. Can you? Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts.
That's right. Just the facts. That's all I'm here for.
All right. Well, at sentencing, the district court designated Timothy Paul Beagle as a SVP. And then on direct appeal, Beagle argued that his SVP designation constituted cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. What did the appellate court hold?
Well, a division of the Court of Appeals rejected this argument based on existing precedent in Allen versus People. I won't give you the citation, but it's available. And the Allen court held that an SVP designation is not punishment, and therefore they chose to respect precedent, and they were in a predicament. Only the Supreme Court of Colorado can change that precedent, so they said, well, we already got our guidance here.
Okay. And then I take it that Mr. Beagle didn't agree with the Court of Appeals there?
He did not agree. The state Supreme Court granted certiorari to consider two questions: whether the SVP designation constitutes criminal punishment under the Eighth Amendment, And two, if so, whether it's cruel and unusual as applied to Beagle.
And was Mr. Beagle a good candidate to undertake such a challenge?
Not exactly an ideal candidate. In July 2019, when he was 49 years old, that's just one less than 50, Beagle picked up two 16-year-old girls who had run away from a treatment facility and allowed them to stay in his home for 10 days. During this time, Beagle provided the two girls with drugs and made sexual advances toward them and sexually assaulted one of them. So I would say he was not the best candidate for such a challenge.
Did he plead guilty or did he take it to trial?
Beagle pleaded guilty to attempted sexual assault and distributing a controlled substance to a minor. An evaluator from the Sex Offender Management Board, otherwise known as SOMB, conducted an assessment using the Sexually Violent Assessment Screening Instrument. And we'll be referring to that periodically, SVPASI. Don't know how to pronounce that. But anyway, that's what we'll be talking about, the screening instrument, which suggested that Beagle met the criteria of an SVP. In particular, Beagle's sex offender scale, risk scale, and that's also an acronym, SORS, score was 34.8, more than 12 points over the threshold to be classified as an SVP.
Now, and you said 12 points, not 1.2, but 12 over the threshold? Not on the borderline, huh?
No, there was no borderline. He was 12 over. The district court found that Beagle met the SVP criteria and designated him as an SVP. The court also found that the SVP designation is not punishment. Now, that means he raised a challenge below, which is correct. If you want a constitutional challenge, you got to give the trial judge. So he raised it below, and the trial judge said it's not punishment. And instead, its stated purpose is to protect the community. The district court sentenced Beagle to a total of 15 years in the custody of the Department of Corrections. And you have to admit the sentence was not excessively harsh, all things considered. I mean, with you perving on two teenage girls that were already in treatment. It's a long sentence, but it's not. You did this in Alabama. Tell me what the KIV does to you.
I think you'd get castrated and thrown into the Gulf of Mexico or something. Mm-hmm. Would you be so kind to explain what the SVP designation means, I guess, in the case of how it is classified for Colorado?
Well, the SVP designation is a heightened classification of a PFR, which carries the additional requirement of lifetime registration under the Colorado PFR Registration Act and requires law enforcement to carry out additional community notification protocols.
And what are the criteria to be designated as an SVP then?
Well, it looks quite long and lengthy. To be designated as an SVP, an offender must be, one, 18 years of age or older when the offense is committed, two, be convicted of an enumerated sex offense or an attempt, solicitation, or conspiracy of one of those enumerated offenses, three, have committed this offense against a victim who was a stranger to the offender or was a person with whom the offender established or promoted relationship primarily for the purpose of sexual victimization, you can start to see how Mr. Beagle fit right into this. Or yeah. Four, to be likely to commit another qualifying sex offense based on the results of the SVP. Let's call that, figure out some way to pronounce that.
Oh, I've got it. It's SVP-ASSY.
SV-PASY. SV-PASY is what I'm going to call it. The results of the SV-PASY.
I like mine better. All right. Well, earlier you mentioned that an evaluator from the Colorado SOMB had administered tests and concluded that Mr. Beagle was 12 points above the presumptive SVP designation. Now, who's on the board and how does it exist?
Well, it's in Colorado statute, Colorado Revised Statutes 16-11.7-103. And it's in the Code of Criminal Procedure that created the SOMB and delegated the creation to the SVPASY to this consultative body. This OMB is comprised of 25 experts in adult and juvenile issues related to persons who commit sex offenses.
I'm sorry, what was that other classification? Adult and what?
Juvenile.
Oh, juvenile. I'm sorry. Okay. Where did you get that from again?
I had a foster parent that pronounced it that way. She was very uneducated, and she would threaten us when we were doing something wrong. She'd say, if you don't stop doing that, you're going to end up in the juvenile hall. You're going to be in trouble with the juvenile court. So anyway, it includes mental health professionals, law enforcement officers, criminal defense attorneys, and judges, among others.
So on paragraph 9, the opinion states, in cases concerning convicted adult PFRs, an SOMB trained evaluator administers the SVP ASI, which is designed to identify offenders who are likely to commit another sexual assault. How do they make that determination?
Well, according to the court, an evaluator can find that an offender is likely to reoffend in one or three ways. One, the offender has previously been convicted of at least one felony PFR type offense, or two, misdemeanor PFR type offense, if such things even exist. Or two, the offender scores above 22 on the sex offender risk, whatever that thing was, the SRS. Or three, the offender meets certain psychopathy and personality disorder criteria. You can see that Mr. Beagle fits in with a couple of those.
Yeah, and I did read that. Also, I'd like to read paragraph 10, and it says, the SORS formula assesses the risk that PFRs will have a new sex or violent court filing within 8 years of a conviction for a qualifying SVP offense. SORS predicts that those who score above a 22 on the assessment fall into a risk group with a 50 to 60 likelihood of reoffending. This sounds very similar to a kabuki machine. How can they predict that? Like, wouldn't you have to have some kind of sample that says these people scored this and within 8 years they did the thing and they would be self-reaffirming itself? I bet you they don't have that data to support this.
I bet they don't. That's why I think you're right. It sounds like the kabuki machine. They say that the SORS formula considers, one, the number of adult criminal cases filed, two, the number of juvenile delinquency cases filed, three, the number of cases with revocation from probation or community corrections, and four, the earliest sex offense filing age. But it's actually the court that actually decides. The opinion states, after the evaluator completes the SVPASI, the district court uses the results as a primary aid to determine whether the offender qualifies as SVP designation under the criteria in section blah, blah, blah.
So what are the downsides? Like, I guess, what is the issue, so to speak, of being designated as an SVP?
Well, the Colorado SORA features registration rules unique to those designated as SVPs. Once designated as SVP, an offender is required to register every 3 months for the remainder of their natural life, and they may not petition for removal from those requirements. And because SVPs have been determined to pose a high enough level of risk to their communities, each local law enforcement agency must implement the SOMB's community notification protocols for any SVP who lives in their jurisdiction.
And you know, we know how this is done in a place like Louisiana. How are they done in a reasonable place like Colorado? How are the notifications done?
Well, currently, according to the court decision, these protocols require law enforcement to use either a town hall style meeting or alternative methods like social media to provide community members with relevant information about SVPs living in their community.
Well, let's move on to the legal aspects of the appeal. What is the standard of review for this kind of case?
Well, that's in paragraph 15. The court stated, quote, we review constitutional questions de novo. We also review questions of statutory interpretation de novo.
Would you remind us what de novo is? Are we talking about Devo, the rock band from the 80s?
No, it means when a lot of appellate cases, when they're going up, there's deference required to what the trial judge, like, say, for example, evidence the veracity of a witness. The trial judge gets to the trier of fact, but it's the jury or the trial judge gets to determine the veracity of witnesses. Well, when it comes to these questions, there's no deference required. It means exactly that. No deference is required to the trial court in its decision on these questions. So what the trial judge said about it being constitutional and it being merely a civil thing, they weren't bound to even consider that. So that's what it, de novo, they take a fresh look at it.
Now, you've also said for years, and probably when you first said it to me, my head kind of spun around a few times, that statutes, when they are signed into law, they are presumed to be constitutional. Why is that?
I have indeed said that. And how many times do you reckon I've said it?
Quite a lot. Probably almost as many times as you've said hello.
Well, that's a longstanding legal doctrine that statutes are entitled to a presumption of constitutionality. And the court acknowledged that and stated, thus, under our separation of powers doctrine, we will not declare a statute unconstitutional without showing that it is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, you know that's a pretty tough standard.
Yep.
And the reason is that lawmakers take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. It's the same oath that the judge takes. Therefore, a co-equal branch of government doesn't presume that lawmakers would put their hand on the Bible and they would take an oath that they had no intention that they do not mean. So they presume that you take your oath seriously, that you would not enact an unconstitutional law. Now, that's wrong, and maybe that doctrine should change, but right now you have to work within the doctrine as it exists. We've, on this program, we've told you about lawmakers saying, we're pushing this bill, and even though we know it's unconstitutional, we're hoping we'll get a different result because we got a different court. We've heard that, right?
I've heard that, yes.
Well, but this doctrine has been around for a very long time, because it was presumed that people wouldn't swear under an oath and then totally disregard it. So it was presumed that you're doing the work in a constitutional fashion. So the burden is on the person who says it's not unconstitutional. Show me, and show with a very high standard of precision, that it's unconstitutional. That means evidence. That means very few summary judgments. You're not going to be able to show a lot of this stuff in a summary judgment.
Beagle argued that the General Assembly intended for the SVP designation to be punishment because it is partially housed in the criminal code and does not otherwise have a legislative declaration espousing a non-punitive purpose. Additionally, he argued that by placing the SVP designation near the section defining habitual PFR sex offenders against children, the legislature communicated a punitive intent akin to this criminal sentence enhancement. Moreover, he contended that the SVP designation is part of a criminal sentence, indicating punitive intent, because the SVPASI evaluation is conducted as a part of the pre-sentence investigation. Now, you've got to admit that those arguments are, I will give some of them, are compelling. I mean, like the location of the stuff in the statute, does that really matter that it's located nearby, therefore it's sort of related to?
I think that's a compelling argument. Now, I think you meant when you said akin, you meant akin. And that's up there above A-K-I-N. Mm-hmm. Its but I will admit that they were compelling. But the court did not find them particularly compelling.
Now, we've also discussed the Supreme Court's decision in Ellenberg. And now, you were not too optimistic that it would change the status quo, as I recall. Now, was Ellenberg argued in this case?
Yes, it was. The court noted on page 20 that, quote, following oral arguments here, and they're talking about here before the Colorado Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court announced Ellenberg. Beagle submitted Ellenberg as supplemental authority, deeming it relevant to his claim and that the legislature intended for the SVP designation to be punishment. So it did not go unnoticed. The lawyers were on it, and they submitted supplemental authority after oral arguments.
So tell us what the issue was with Ellenberg. Can you remind us about that?
In Ellenberg, the court analyzed the text and structure of the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, or otherwise MVRA, and found that Congress intended the statute to be punishment. The court identified several features of MVRA that made it abundantly clear when viewed as a whole, the act imposed punishment. These features included, one, the MVRA labeling restitution as a penalty. Now imagine that. If you call it a penalty, that would be pretty strong evidence that it was intended to be punitive, right?
That would be, yes.
And two, restitution being is imposed under the MVRA during sentencing. Three, the government, not the victim, is the party adverse to the defendant when restitution is ordered. And four, allowing restitution for misdemeanors to be imposed in lieu of other punishments, such as imprisonment, making it the sole punishment for those offenses. That would imply that it's punishment. I mean, we're building momentum here with Congress saying it's punishment. And five, allowing noncompliance with restitution payments to result in court modification of supervised release, probation, or even imprisonment. And six, the MVRA being codified in the criminal code section, which in and of itself is not dispositive. But the biggest thing is it being labeled as punishment. That goes a long way, because with the PFR registration, if the legislature says in their preamble, in order to punish these bastards, we have this, then that would end the inquiry. There would be nothing else to litigate. It would fall as being unconstitutional under the Ex Post Facto Act provision. But they don't do that.
I'm assuming that along with myself, that everyone else, when you got past like the second one, our eyes rolled back in our heads and whatnot. Can you make this like one or two sentences on what they said?
Yes, I know it was kind of complicated. In essence, they said Congress proclaimed its intent to be punishment, and it is indeed punishment. And as I'm saying, if we can find a legislative enactment on registration, it says to punish these people, we are requiring this, then it will be punishment. There will be no proof needed, because that's the part, the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez test. If Congress, if the lawmaking body says it's punishment, that ends the inquiry. If they call it, if they don't declare it specifically punishment, then there has to be that seven-factor analysis.
Can you at least admit that there are some similarities then?
Yes, I can admit that, and the court did as well. They said the SVP designation scheme shares some of the features identified in Ellenberg. The SVP designation is imposed at sentencing. The people remain an adverse party. The designation is located in the criminal code, and compliance with PFR registration is often a condition of probation or parole. So noncompliance could result in modification of such terms, including revocation. They went on to say that SVP designation definitely lacks the remaining two statutory features identified in Ellenberg. It is not labeled as a penalty for a criminal offense, and is not imposed in lieu of other punishments. And that's kind of what I said when we discussed Ellenberg.
And therefore, the punishment argument failed?
It did. The court said, when viewed as a whole, the features of the SVP designation do not indicate punitive intent.
On paragraph 28, the court stated, we turn to the seven Mendoza-Martinez factors to consider whether the punitive effects of the SVP designation sufficiently outweigh the legislature's non-punitive intent. Do you feel like you could quickly explain those? Not like you did the other ones where our eyes rolled in the back of our heads. Can you do this quickly?
Well, I'm just going to let the court do it. they say to analyze a measure, to analyze whether a measure is punitive in effect, courts have considered the seven factors articulated in Mendoza-Martinez, namely whether, one, it involves an affirmative disability restraint, which is my favorite one.
Yep.
Two, has historically been regarded as punishment. But listing your name with the government has not historically been regarded as punishment, I don't think. Three, comes into play on a finding of scienter, and not even the legal professionals can explain that one, so I won't bother. And four, whether it promotes the traditional aims of punishment, retribution, and deterrence. Five, applies to behavior that's already a crime. Six, has an alternative purpose to which it may be rationally connected. And finally, seven, appears excessive in relation to the alternative purpose assigned.
Beagle compares his case to TB, which the Colorado Supreme Court held that CSORA's lifetime registration and community notification requirements, as applied to juveniles, Larry, juveniles, got it? Juveniles, were punishment under Mendoza-Martinez. If something is punitive to juveniles, is it not punitive to adults?
No, it is not necessarily punitive to adults, just because it's punitive to juveniles. The court explained that. They stated under the seventh Mendoza Martinez factor, we deemed lifetime registration for Juvenile. Oh, you said, how did you pronounce that?
Juveniles, not Juveniles.
We deemed lifetime registration for Juveniles excessive because, one, it brands Juveniles as irredeemably depraved based on acts committed before reaching adulthood. Two, disregards Juveniles' tremendous capacity for reform. And three, applies for a greater percentage of a juvenile's life by the very fact of the offender's youth. Now, you've got to admit there's some logic in that.
Perhaps. But it takes away that literally the day you turn 18 that you are no longer redeemable, that you are not just one day older than you were the day before. But in addition, I noted that they also stated, we also judged in opposite Smith versus Doe, in which the Supreme Court held that the PFR notification requirements at issue did not constitute public shaming because they involved the dissemination of accurate information about a criminal record, most of which is already public. We emphasized that this rationale did not necessarily apply in the juvenile context, and so the dissemination of information about juvenile PFRs thus appears more punitive in light of the presumptive confidentiality of most other juvenile adjudications.
And that is a valid point because most states, with the exception of probably Alabama, have decided that determined that they want their juvenile system to be more rehabilitative and less focused on punishment. That's a public policy position that they've taken by shielding juvenile records and by expunging them and all the things that they do for juveniles that they don't do for adults. So they're looking, they're not comparing an apples comparison. They're comparing adult jurisprudence with juvenile jurisprudence, and it's two different, completely two different things. The court also noted that C. Colorado Soros automatic lifetime registration requirement for repeat offenders, juvenile offenders, was retributive under the fourth Mendoza-Martinez factor because there was no individualized risk assessment. They went on to say, in contrast, here the SVP designation applies only to adult offenders whose conviction information is already a matter of public record. Moreover, the designation only applies to such offenders after the completion of an individualized risk assessment via the SVPACE. Now, see, you guys that are so in favor of risk assessments, you see, sometimes they bite you in the rear.
I don't think that's what you said on our phone call earlier.
What did I say?
I believe that you use the similar to the SVP ASI. You used a word more like that.
Uh-huh.
In paragraph 37, the court stated, applying the seven Mendoza-Martinez factors to this case, we conclude that two of them weigh in favor of finding the SVP designation punitive, one is neutral, and four weigh against. Now, what did they determine about your favorite, whether it imposes any disabilities and restraints?
They didn't determine any disabilities or restraint. They said in Smith v. Doe, the court found Alaska's lifetime PFR registration requirements do not constitute an affirmative disability or restraint because they do not resemble imprisonment. They're paradynamic. How do you pronounce that? Paradynamic affirmative disability or restraint. He failed to show any disabilities that were directly imposed by CSORA. He referred to locally imposed restrictions that are not imposed by the state of Colorado.
Do we have any distinction of what that was, what the state did versus what the statute did?
Well, there's no restrictions as far as I'm telling Colorado where you can live,
right.
But locals, communities do. So, you know, don't complain to the state. You need to go complain to your city council and your county commissioners.
I see. All right. Well, then the court stated the legislative text associated with the SVP designation clearly indicates that this non-punitive purpose is community protection. They cited CRS 16-22-112, which explains that CSORA aims to provide the public access to information and that SVPs pose a high enough level of risk to the community and that community notification is meant to spread information and education to the community concerning supervision and treatment of sex offenders. Now, why can't they admit the obvious that it's punishment?
Well, they did admit it, sort of. They stated, ultimately, although certain aspects of the SVP designation may resemble punishment, they do not, by the clearest of proof, outweigh the legislature's non-punitive intent. Simply put, Beagle did not carry the burden of proof.
All right, well, then what happens next?
this case is dead for all practical purposes. He's lost. A petition for the U.S. Supreme Court will not turn the ship around, in my view.
And then before we move on, I noticed that two justices wrote separately. Do you mind if I read the first paragraph and then get your opinion on what was said?
Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, Chief Justice Marquez, joined by Justice Gabriel, they stated, although I join the majority's opinion, I write separately to highlight concerns with the sexually violent predator designation raised by Colorado's Sex Offender Management Board. They warrant the General Assembly's attention. In the nearly 35 years since it first became part of Colorado law, scientific research has called into question the effectiveness of the SVP designation in reducing recidivism and protecting the public. The SOMB agrees and has repeatedly recommended that the General Assembly eliminate the SVP designation and replace it with a system better aligned with modern research. Given these concerns, I respectfully urge the legislature to review the relevant research and consider whether the SVP designation continues to serve its intended purpose. Now, I mean, that sounds pretty amazing right there. Do you think they will reconsider the intended purpose?
I really don't. I think it's a long shot, but it's possible. But my opinion is the legislature will need more than a respectful request. There's no incentive for them to make this change, particularly now since the court has upheld the designation as being constitutional. Why would they go out on a limb? Now try to put yourself in a competitive legislative race. Why would you go out on a limb to eliminate a provision that has been held as of yesterday to be constitutional, or 2 days ago when this came out? Why would you go out to say, I tell you what I'm going to do. If you give me a chance to go back to Denver and represent you, I'm going to take this provision out of the off the books. There's just
no
gas
mileage. Do you think anybody in Colorado talks like that?
I suspect they do in the Eastern Plains out there in the farming areas and Holly and places like that. I think they do.
But so I guess from the judge's point of view in them saying that, they ruled based on like how the law works and is it unconstitutional based on their interpretation of all that. However, they then put in their personal opinion on whether they should go back and redo this based on the evidence and science and things of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, you're being logical and so are the judges, but logic is not, the political system is not based entirely on logic. It's based on political needs and reality.
I hate when you tell me this too, by the way. I always hate when you tell me this.
Well, I can't help it. It's our system.
No, I get it. And I've come around again. My head spins every time. Like, it should be based on evidence and logic and reason. However, it's based on emotion. And I've been trying to figure out how to bring this into the podcast. You can't use logic and reason, that which you didn't use logic and reason to get into. We got into all these laws based on emotion. We're not going to be able to use logic and reason to get out of them.
Well, if you can figure out how to make it unconstitutional for lawmakers to go out and campaign with vitriolic statements and dirty politics and put this to rest, that nobody can say that this person proposed taking the SVP designation off the books after it being ruled constitutional. But you can't do that. Anybody running for office in Colorado can say, he done that and he didn't have to. The court had just upheld it.
Right. I understand, Larry. I understand. Anything else before we head out?
Well, I think this was one of our best episodes. I said that last week, the last time, but I think this one's even better.
I think every episode is better than the one previous.
Well, all righty then.
We were possibly going to have a Colorado person on, but he decided to go gallivanting across the United States. So I'm calling you out, individual in Colorado, that you were not here. You let me down. I'm telling you. There should be punishment.
There should be, and I think he could have added some color commentary to stuff that we truly don't understand that a person living there would.
Absolutely. Totally, totally. All right. Well, then please head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and links everywhere you need to go. You can email me as in what somebody else did this week. I can't remember the person's name, but registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And you can leave an old-fashioned voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And of course, head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. And then you can become a patron for as little little as a dollar a month. And I'm trying to remember who the patron was this week. And I just sorted by join date and I get stuff from 2021. How about, nope, that's definitely not it. There was a person that joined and I want to say thank you very much. You know what? It was a person that changed their Patreon and they made it more. That's what it was. And that's why their join date didn't change.
It was up to stimulus payment amount now, correct?
That is very close to correct. Yes, it absolutely was. And without anything else, and also fypeducation.org/shop, and you can even get a customized shirt. If you want something that's slightly different than what's available there, my guy can make it happen for you. And that's what happened just last week. Someone wanted one of the items on the back of the shirt instead of on the front, and we made it happen. So there you go.
I have a question. Has anyone taken my offer that they need to wear the Kabuki shirt to their polygraph exam?
I think I heard that people were thinking about it, but I don't think anybody has yet. But so we should reiterate this. What will you do for them?
Well, I'll give them a gift card. I'll give them a gift card.
For what, $5 at McDonald's or something?
No, a nice gift card. If you, of course, I can't defend you if you get thrown in jail for sure.
Well, I mean, what are they going to do? They're going to just be like, every answer you're going to give is a lie because you've offended me with your shirt?
I don't know what they might do. I don't trust these people.
I wouldn't trust them either. If they're using the Kabuki machine to evaluate whether you were telling the truth or not, like, seriously. All right. Well, thank you all for joining us tonight. We ended up with a nice little crowd here, Larry. And I hope you have a good weekend too, Larry. And I will talk to you very soon.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.